Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome back to the Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, world's leading authority on director Arthur Terry, director of such great films as Gals and Gobs, The Haunted Chiffarobe, I Load My Gun with Bullets, Each Morning I Awake, many other classic films. We're going to be talking more about Arthur Terry in the very near future. I don't want to make any promises I can't keep, but Arthur has indicated that he may be a guest on the podcast ere long. And since this is his first recorded interview since roughly 1961, when he released his ill-fated Sit Lassie Stay, this is a big deal for me, and I'm looking forward to it. But that can wait. That's coming up someday. Someday soon, I hope, but someday. Now, in addition to being the leading authority on Arthur Terry, I've not been a slouch in my life. I think I've been a busy guy. I've been a fairly productive guy. I've published lots of books. I've published many hundreds of articles and worked for 20 years on TV until the president of television called me up and personally asked me to stop. Was in lots of bands as a fledgling musician. Had some of my songs recorded and have been on other records and have done lots of live performance, and I was in a comedy improv troupe. I've been a busy, busy guy. But when I compare myself against today's guest, this episode's guest, John Marsalis, I feel like I ain't done nothing at all. I feel like I've just been sitting by, like one of those hayseeds in a Tex Avery cartoon with the music going do-do-do-do-do-do-do, just sitting around with a straw in my mouth and watching the world go by. Because John Marsalis is an accomplished son of a gun. Now, most of you, if you're listening to this, you're probably coming at him from the movie angle, and that's certainly the way I have, because he is a tremendous accompanist of silent films, a terrific pianist, and also incredibly knowledgeable about the history of silent film. I've always thought of him as primarily a Lon Chaney authority, but he put me straight in the interview that you're about to hear. I don't think I insulted him by saying that, but it was just my impression. But he feels that that's not painting him with the right kind of brush. And but he's also a toxicologist. He has a Bachelor of Science degree in zoology and molecular biology. He's got a Master's of Science degree in genetics from North Carolina State University. He has two PhDs in toxicology and genetics. And he saves lives all the time. Drugs come through for his review and his analysis, and he has had an enormous impact on the health industry, and he's just an impressive fellow. And so, you know, I'm hoping that plenty of people are interviewing John Marsalis about that stuff, because that is literally life-changing things. We'll talk a little bit about it in this coming interview, but not too much, because clearly I know nothing about toxicology, nothing. And so I would have no questions to ask except, so what is toxicology? Which is not a good question. It is a question, but not a good one. But because I have known John slightly for a long time, I would not say we hang out, but we see each other at CineCon every year, and I certainly have admired his accompanying scores every year. I always look forward to hearing him. He's got a distinctive voice on the piano, and I like the way he plays, and I like the voicings he uses, and I just like to listen to him accompany silent films. And so that's what we're talking about today, mostly. His work as a pianist, his knowledge in film history, and all things wrapped up in that. And I think that you will be fascinated at him and what he has to say, because you'll be surprised to learn he's also incredibly articulate and incredibly smart. And so I just had a great time talking with him, and I hope that you will have a great time listening. So here's my conversation with John Marsalis, and I'll see you on the other side.
Well, I guess for starters, I'm not a professional musician. I'm a PhD toxicologist who does science for a living. But the way I started in film and music both was a lot of influence from my parents. My parents were movie buffs. My dad was actually a projectionist in World War II. He followed the Normandy invasion in because he had some technical skill. He was one of the radio repair guys. He would repair and run the Jan 16mm projectors and run films. So ever since I was as little as I can remember, it was a sort of a family thing to see silent films. And then my mother was a piano teacher, so I began playing piano at age 4. And she gave me lessons, and I continued as long as I could stand it with learning from your parents. And then I switched to guitar for a number of years and played guitar in a loud rock band, and probably one of my dubious fames to claim or indirect connection to fame is, if you remember the song Precious and Few, that was a big hit. That was written by my guitar teacher, Walt Nims, back in his days after he left the Outsiders, which was a Cleveland band that he was in when I was taking lessons from him.
My band used to do cover versions of that song.
I was very interested in old films. I was especially interested in horror films. I'd been a big horror movie buff ever since I saw King Kong when I was age 4, and I read Famous Monsters of Filmland, as many people of that generation did. And a couple sort of important events that happened in my life. In the summer after my junior year in college, I was a big King Kong fan, and because of some odd broadcast restrictions, the local TV stations couldn't broadcast it because it was within the same region as another station that had the package, but I couldn't pick up that other station in the old antenna days. And so a local library was running King Kong. I thought, oh, great, I'll go down and see it for free. And it turned out it was run by it was a series done by the big business Sons of the Desert tent in Cleveland. And I said, gosh, you know, where did you get the print? And they pointed to this 15-year-old kid and said, oh, he owns it. And I said, he owns a film? And I think when this little kid can own a print, you know, I can collect films too. So I sort of entered this world of film collecting. This group of new friends that I had met took me to my first CineCon in 1974 in New Haven, Connecticut, and I began buying 8mm films. But at that convention, they ran Woman in the Moon, the Fritz Lang that I'd always wanted to see, and Stu Oderman was the accompanist, and he sat down and began playing, and I was just mesmerized. And, you know, I heard this when it was over. I don't even remember who I was sitting next to, but I turned to them and I said, I don't know how he does that. I'm going to learn to do that. And so I went back, and I was in the beginning of my senior year in college, and I just started playing. And I remember I used Metropolis as sort of my case study film. What would I play for this? And so I liberally stole music from any place I could, and I kind of started to work out in my head what I might do. Shortly after that, I went to graduate school at North Carolina State. I arrived. They had a very active film program. Within 2 weeks, I was on the film committee. Within one semester, I was running it. I had talked to the woman who's one of the faculty advisors, and she knew that I was kind of interested in playing for films, and they had booked The Birth of a Nation, of all things. Nice short film to start your career with. Sure. And, she said, you know, it was supposed to come in with a soundtrack. It doesn't have a track. Could you play for it? And I was just scared to death. I thought, oh my gosh, I'm not ready for this, but what the heck? She talked me into it. And so she loaned me the film just a couple days before. I'd never actually seen the film at the time. And I watched it, and I sort of put notes together on what I would play. And I played it. And I actually still have a recording of that score. It's horrible. You will never hear it. No living soul will ever hear it. It's awful. But when it was over, I got this long-standing ovation from the audience because they'd never heard anything like that. And that started it off. And so that was the first film I played for. I went to the Columbus Cine Event that year. That would be 1976 then. I remember they ran the film, it's the Richard Talmadge, Let's Go. and it was 7 o'clock. John Stingley was running the convention. Stu Oderman was playing. He was late coming back from dinner. They were panicking. And John Stingley, being funny, stood up and said, "Is there a pianist in the audience?" And I kind of sheepishly held up my hand, and I knew John. And he said, "You play for films?" I said, "Well, I'm not very good, but I have done it." And so he said, "You're on." So I began playing. 5 minutes in, Stu Oderman came in, and we switched places on the bench. And Stu said, "You play?" He said, "Well, great. Now you can give me a break." So the next thing I knew, I was playing for films, and that's sort of how it started. So, you know, and at first you're terrible. You steal from everyone you can steal from. But over time you get better. And North Carolina State was a great training ground because we had lots and lots of silence. I could book as many silence as I wanted. It's not exactly what I would call a sophisticated audience. It's not like being in San Francisco or New York City where, you know, you have other great companies to compare to. They had nothing to compare to. And they just thought I was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And after, you know, I spent 6 years in North Carolina, and by the end of that 6 years, I was not too bad. And then when I moved to the San Francisco Bay Area, I kind of sort of stepped in, you know, and began playing there. Even then, I mean, it's sort of my entry to the Bay Area was kind of almost a similar situation to the Let's Go story. I went to see a Todd Browning double feature of The 13th Chair and The Unknown. And they had this beautiful grand piano sitting there, and I heard they were going to run The Unknown silent. And I was kind of stunned by that. And I went up to Edith Kramer, who's the director of the archive at the time, and she didn't know me from Adam. And I said, "Well, you know, I play for films. I mean, I'm happy to play for The Unknown for you." Bob Vaughn was their regular accompanist, and I think they had just decided not to book him for a 50-minute movie that night. And she was very wary, and then Rob McKay and Jack Tilmany and a few others were there, and they kind of interceded in my behalf and said, no, he's actually, you know, pretty good. You ought to let him play." I played. It went over well, and the next thing I knew, I was the house pianist at PFA. So it's, you know, I've kind of stumbled into these situations of playing, and so I've been playing now for, oh, you know, what would I have to think, whatever 1976 to today is, you know, 36 years, something like that. Yeah, and I've lost count, but I've certainly played for hundreds and hundreds of features, and I don't know how many shorts.
Now, you said that when you played that first score for Birth of a Nation, you kind of compiled it in you watched it a couple of days ahead of time and compiled it. When you're here at CineCon, and for the listeners, although this won't air for a couple of weeks, we're in the middle of CineCon at Labor Day, and you play for usually 4 or 5 silents over the weekend. But a lot of these have got to be things that you've never had a chance to prepare for, right? I mean,
I don't believe I've seen any of the films I've played for this weekend. I've played them all cold.
Yeah. So, do you simply have in your mind a catalog, as it were, of things that you think would work, or are you simply just playing what you think works at the moment? I mean, do you have, if there's a storm at sea, do you have something, "Well, I'll go to my storm at sea," kind of music?
There, you certainly have stock music in your head. And getting back to that first Birth of a Nation I played for, I probably had 2 chase scenes, you know, 2 love themes, you know, a couple melodrama themes, and used a lot
and
of filler.
Dixie, yeah.
And for, you know, 2.5 hours, that makes it a long slog. And now I've sort of got hundreds in my head, and I just pull them out. So it's partly that. I mean, I like to go in thinking, you know, what am I going to play for this? But very often I know almost nothing about it. I don't like doing it that way, but it's, you know, I can do it. I can handle it. You do sometimes get caught. I actually made a horrendous goof yesterday playing for Upstream, the John Ford. And
It wasn't horrendous. It was a logical leap.
And to describe the scene, since people obviously can't see it here, there's a scene where this fella he's become a star, and he's leaving this boarding house of actors, and they begin playing the piano, and so I'm thinking they're going to play for "He's a Jolly Good Fellow," and then the title comes on the screen. They're playing "Auld Lang Syne," and I know "Auld Lang Syne," I can do it in my sleep, but when you're in the middle of playing one piece and another one comes, I'm going, "Auld Lang Syne, no, it's not that." And I started launching into something, and I realized I was playing "Home Sweet Home." I go, "Oh, dang, that's not it either." And By the time I got it in my head what it was and was about to play it, then the scene was over. So you do get caught. The other thing I call it's the dreaded needle drop. Common in silent films, you'll see someone go over to a record and they'll put a needle on, and then you'll see what the piece is.
Yeah.
And if you've never seen the film, you're going, ah, I know that. Wait, I know this. But you're playing something else, and you just can't. If I could stop playing for 5 seconds, I'd get it in my head. And you're almost tempted to do that, to stop, get it in your head, and then start playing. So that's one of the downsides of playing cold. But, you know, you try and make it work.
No, I used to do improv, and I feel about the same way, that audiences are willing to give you a certain amount when they know you're winging it. And so, you know, last night when you started with For He's a Jolly Good Fellow and then segued into Auld Lang Syne via Home Sweet Home, I think everybody in the room understood what had happened and how you had come to this, because everybody in the room would have done the same thing.
Yeah,
we had no idea. Yeah, we had no idea what was coming up. And when they all started singing as the guy walks down the steps, of course it's For He's a Jolly Good Fellow. What else would it be?
Yeah. So you get a little surprises.
Yeah. But now you do scores on occasion for Kino and video companies and so forth. What's your procedure there?
Well, so that's a little more complicated, and I actually don't really like recording. I find it kind of confining. I'm very, you know, when I play live, I like to be lively and flamboyant and make it a fun score, and you know, and it's sloppy, and I make mistakes. I feel very self-conscious about doing that when it's going to be recorded and people are going to be listening to it long after I'm dead. And so I have to tone it down quite a bit and do a more, what I would call, describe as a conservative score. I also have to be a little more careful about copyrighted music that I use. The main reason I started agreeing to do scores, because I got asked for years and I'm not really interested in doing this, is that, you know, as my kids started growing up, I was thinking, well, you know, someday I'll be gone, and they're going to say to their kids, oh, you know, your grandfather played piano for silent films. They'll say, oh, do you have any recordings? Well, no, he never recorded anything. So I didn't want that to happen. So, you know, I began doing some things. I've done things for Kino and Flickr Alley, Milestone. I've done some things for Warner Brothers, for Turner. And it's a mixed bag, but there, typically, they will send me out what's called a time-coded video, and it's got a little digital clock on the bottom of the screen down to the hundredth of a second. And I will take notes, and, you know, you want to get the gunshot spot on. You want to get, sure, you know, the crashes spot on. And so I'll take, you know, kind of detailed notes of, especially of events that happened. And then I'll practice it a bit. I'll have an idea in my head of what I'm going to play, but still go in. I'm largely improvising. And the studio didn't know quite what to make of me, because I would say, well, I'm doing this film. It's an hour and a half movie, and so I'll need to book a two-hour slot. And they look at me like I'm crazy. This is going to take us 3 days. No, it's not. They said, well, you're only going to do it in 2 hours if you're a one-take wonder. And I said, well, I'm only going to do one. I'm only planning on doing one take. And every now and then I will make some horrendous mistake, and I go, stop. And then we'll roll it back, and I'll say, you know, started it, you know, at, you know, 43 minutes and 22 seconds again, and then I give notes. And then I send the, and so what they end up coming out with is a digital master, and without getting into the technical, I mean, it's got an audible time code that syncs up to the microsecond between sound and picture. And I just send that time-coded digital copy off to the production house. I mean, Brett Wood has done a lot of the, you know, very fine post-production for Kino. And I send it off, and they match it up, and the magic happens, and then it comes out.
Do you ever write songs, or do you ever compose music apart from film?
Not apart from film. In fact, people often will be at a party. They'll say, oh, John plays piano. Get him to play. I say, no, you don't understand. I don't play piano. I accompany films. There's a difference. You know, you wouldn't ask Bernard Herrmann or Miklos Rocha to sit down and, oh, you know, play something. You write music. No, they don't. They compose film music. Typically, no. Having said that, I've done all sorts of unusual things over the years of putting music together. A strange one I did was I did the score for the relatively recent Anna May Wong documentary that Elaine May Wu produced.
Mm-hmm.
And that was odd, because the video came with instructions of, you know, we need 47 seconds of music here. We need 19 seconds of music here. And so I was working, and that was a very low budget. I did that in my basement, just literally plugging my keyboard into a laptop. And it came out pretty well, all things considered. But then after I was done with what I thought was the final cut, where I'd put together this you know, very nicely orchestrated piece running through the end credits, they decided to change it and re-edit it. So then they had to start taking my music and cutting it in different ways. And, you know, it's okay. It came out fine. But that was one of the more strange things I did.
Sure. It must be irksome to a certain extent.
Well, it is, but it's not. I understand the way the films get made, and I'm pretty flexible. Without naming names, there are prima donnas out there who get upset if you take a snippet of their music to put it on the DVD menu, you know, without their approval.
I think I know at least one of them.
It's hard to describe. I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, knowing what to play, you've either got it or you don't. And I know some very, very fine pianists. And I'm really not a very good pianist. I mean, technically, I'm a B-minus pianist. But to me, I think I just have a sense of I know what works and what doesn't. And I would say other accompanists have styles. When I hear something like on Turner or, you know, on a DVD or something, I'll say, oh, that's Phil Carley. I'll recognize it. You know, and it's funny how everybody has their own different strengths. You know, Frederick Hodges, there is nobody better for comedy. There's just nobody better. He is the god. And I love his stuff. And it's a ragtime style. It's a certain style. You know, he's terrific. He has this huge repertoire. You know, Phil Carley is a great all-around accompanist. You know, Robert Israel, I think, is the best person around doing orchestral scores. So, I mean, you know, everybody has their own strengths. You know, my personal thing, I love doing swashbucklers and horror films. And interestingly, I don't get to play them a lot here. If I had to name my, you know, 10 or 15 best scores, you know, they're mostly swashbucklers, horror films, or mystery thrillers. I mean, you know, things like, and in fact, probably some of my best scores are, you know, Robin Hood, The Man Who Laughs, Peter Pan, which is kind of fantasy. The Wind, Thief of Baghdad. I mean, you know, those kinds of things. It's something you can really sink your teeth into.
Yeah.
So we have different strengths. I'm not very good at comedy. I actually don't like playing comedies very much. You know, if it's a Harold Lloyd or a Keaton that's got more substance to it, then yeah. But I mean, actually playing Max Sennett comedies is kind of the price I have to pay for being at these things. In fact, I'm in a few hours. I'm playing for Bluff, which I'm told is not very good and it's probably not very funny. And I'll struggle through it.
Well, I always think that you work really well with, for lack of a better term, Americana type films. Or I mean, like last night with Upstream, I thought that was just the right tone for that film. It was a beautiful job. And I always, there's something about your chord tonalities and the way you structure things that for some reason work really well for me. If it's a kind of a rural or Americana thing, it seems like you have a real nice atmosphere for those things. And I've never heard you play a horror film at all. I've never heard a single time.
Well, so. God, well, you should do something like The Magician sometime. Man Who Laughs isn't really horror, but when actually I did the score for the Milestone Phantom of the Opera, which was more troubling because I had to learn all the Faust music, which I worked in, just to be, appropriate and historically correct, but not something I would necessarily choose to use in a film if I was just playing it live. But
do you ever record with other instruments or with synthesizers or anything like that?
So I've been, what I've spent a lot of time the last 10 years doing, and sadly I haven't done too much of it in live performances, you know, here at Cinecon, is I have a very high-end digital keyboard. It's Kurzweil. It's basically, people say it's a synthesizer. Well, no, it's not. When you play middle C set to clarinet, you're hearing a recording of the first clarinetist of the Boston Symphony playing a middle C, which is what it is. And I've been doing those. I play that quite regularly at the Niles Film Museum, sort of one of my regular gigs where I play almost once a month. And so I do that a lot. I actually like orchestral scores much more so than piano, and it works well. But there are some things that piano works well.
Yeah, I heard you play that with, it wasn't Robin Hood.
Yeah, I did Robin Hood here, and that's okay. An example of the kinds of things I do. It sounds like a full orchestral score, mm-hmm. And what you can do now with the digital keyboards is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I'm always real sensitive to that stuff, but it's getting better and better all the time. I heard a violin program, a Stradivarius violin program, by Garriton, I think was the company, and it sounded like a violin to me. I mean, I was shocked because I usually, even though it's kind of okay, it still sounds like something's, you know, amiss, but they're getting better.
Yeah, well, more and more. I mean, you're even finding, you don't even realize it, but in you know, commercial motion pictures today, a lot of it is digital music, and what they'll do is they'll put enough, you know, real instruments in. You know, Robert Israel calls it fattening the sound, where you'll lay it out on a, you know, on a digital instrument of some kind, you know, and then you'll bring some orchestral instruments in, and it gives it just enough that you can't quite tell. I mean, a good example of that is the score for Dragon, the Bruce Lee movie by I think it's Randy Adelman. You know, much of that is at least to me sounds digital. But you can tell there's some real instruments in there, and it makes a very nice mix. But it's frankly an inexpensive, practical way to do the score.
Sure.
You don't need a 50-piece orchestra with Carl Davis, as wonderful as that is. You know, you can put it together with a composer with a digital score and get, you know, and then lay it down and then bring in, you know, half a dozen studio musicians to fill in a few key places, and it's enough of a difference that it sounds, you know, like a real orchestral score.
Yeah, I was talking with a composer not too long ago, and he said his main instrument is the French horn, and so what he always does is he'll lay out the entire score, and then he'll come in with his French horn, and he'll play along, and
yeah,
just to give it a little element of live performance.
Today's version of karaoke, I guess.
Yeah. So, well, speaking of horror, where did the interest in Chaney come from?
Well, again, I think that comes back to my early horror movie days. And in fact, really, I mean, even through college, I mean, I wasn't, you know, I liked, you know, current films and I enjoyed seeing film, but it wasn't really until kind of late in my college years and into graduate school that I even discovered that there was a world much outside of that. You know, I read Famous Monsters Filmland. There was a regular series called Lon Chaney Shall Not Die. And, you know, let's face it, back then, you know, you got to see Phantom of the Opera and The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and that's it. That's all there was. So I was fascinated, but, you know, who is this actor, and why can I not see any of the films? Because I had no concept at the time of what a lost film was. So I became, you know, when I began collecting films, I was excited. Ooh, I can buy a print of The Shock and Nomads of the North. And then over time, you know, you begin to realize there's this other world out there. So I became very interested in Chaney. And I like Chaney, but it's not like, oh, you know, Chaney's the greatest thing out there. I'm very interested in him. He was a very interesting actor. But it was sort of like the quest of the unattainable. If all the Chaney films survived and I could see them all, I probably would have seen them, been done with it, and moved on with interest to someone else. But it was just so interesting, especially the early period. You know, everyone gets worked up over the MGMs. And I said, well, you know, the MGMs are fine. You know, there's some really great films in there. But I'm really interested in the teens universals, where there's just so few out there. I mean, I don't have on the top of my head, you know, all the numbers right now, but Chaney appeared in about 160 films, and a lot has been turning up over the years, but I think there's something like 53 or 54 survive right now, and a number of those are in fragments. So, I mean, complete films, I don't think it's much more than something in the low 30s. And, you know, so that's terrible. You know, we talk about D.W. Griffith, and he made, was it 457 biographs, and I think four are lost.
Yeah.
You know, something like that, or four, maybe seven. You know, and you know, 80% of Chaney's output is gone, and so it's the goal of the unattainable. Ooh, I want to see more of this stuff. So that was kind of my interest in Chaney, and I began amassing, you know, material on Chaney. I would go to Library of Congress in Washington and go through all the motion picture worlds and, you know, try and find what I could about films, and it sort of became an obsession, as many things are with collectors. But my interests are pretty broad. I mean, I have a pretty large 16mm film collection, and Chaney's a pretty small proportion of that.
Well, you had intended to write a book about Chaney, and maybe you even wrote it.
Well, so it's a long story. Some of it I won't even go into.
I got nothing but time.
Well, at a time, Michael Blake and I were talking about doing a book together. I was working on a filmography. He was working on a biography. For a variety of reasons, we parted amicably. And he went off and did, you know, three very good books. it was frustrating trying to get something like that published. I went actually was talking with Citadel for doing a Films Of, and they said, well, who the heck is Lon Chaney? You know, wasn't he in Of Mice and Men? I said, well, you know, wrong one. And there was an editor there, and I'm blanking on his name now, but, you know, it was very sympathetic, but he said, well, don't feel bad. He said, you know, we just turned down the films of Burt Lancaster.
Yeah, because who's he, right?
Yeah. And so it wasn't commercial. So about this time was when the web started taking off. And, of course, actually, I worked for the company that invented the web. You know, SRI International, where I work, is, you know, we invented domain names, the mouse. You know, we, until 1991, we gave out every URL address in the world. And so in the early 90s, I said, you know, I wonder if I can take all this material I have and create a website. So I created a website that originally was on AOL, but now I've actually picked up LonChaney.org. So I'll make a shameless plug for the website, and I put things there. I don't have nearly enough time to keep up with it, but I do have complete filmography and quite a bit of information on there. And so instead of publishing, again, I have good gainful employment as a scientist. I don't need the money from a book deal with a vanity publisher. So I just put it on the web. It's there free, and people can do what they want with it. I mean, the web is a great resource. The website has been good for me in the sense that it has drawn people to me in interesting ways. As an example, I was contacted, this is quite a few years ago now, probably 10 years ago, by a woman who was the step-granddaughter of George Chaney, who was Lon Chaney's youngest brother. And George had passed away many years earlier, but then the woman he married passed away, and then this granddaughter was had the job of dealing with the estate. And she said, well, he had all these pictures, and I don't know what they're worth. And so I said, well, you know, how can I get it appraised? I said, you know, if you send me photocopies, I'd be happy to appraise it. And so she sent it, and you know, a third of it was junk. A third of it was, you know, nice originals at MGMs, and a third of it was, oh my God. because the oh my God third was these early universals where Chaney would write notes to his brother and say, you know, and he'd write, you know, this is me, I played a Russian count, and things like that. And I told her, I said, these are very valuable, and I said, and I'm very interested in them. To make a long story short, I ended up negotiating a deal, and I bought the whole package of stills. And it was interesting. There were some amazing Chaney Jr. things, you know, and I ended up selling those for a pretty substantial sum of money. One was a very young, you know, Creighton Chaney signing, you know, to my beloved aunt and uncle, you know, your nephew, and that he sent to his Uncle George. So I unloaded some of those things. But some of these you can see in the Kevin Brownlow documentary that he, you know, things where there are signs with notes where, you know, Chaney would put an X above the picture in the margin and say, you know, this is, and then write a note on the back. And so those were some of the things I got. So that's the kind of thing that has come to me through the website. I get a lot of cranks, too, a lot of people who insist that London After Midnight exists, and they know it's out there, and they want to know why I'm withholding it, and the...
Well, that's going to be my next question. Why are you withholding?
Yeah, why am I withholding London After Midnight? And that's I think it's Michael Gebert has a very funny site that's a website that, you know, proof that London After Midnight exists, and he's pieced together all, you know, was in the Black Hawk catalog,
sure,
and things like
I've
that.
I've seen some of those, yeah.
Everyone insists it's out there, and my response is, I'll believe it when I see it.
I'm of the minority opinion, I guess, that of all the lost Chaneys, it is in the lower third of the ones that I'm eager to see. There's a lot of stuff that I would be avid to see before London After Midnight.
Oh, you're not minority opinion, actually. People who actually, you know, follow Chaney realize that it was a turkey.
Yeah.
It.
I've seen Mask of the
Vampire. Mark of the Vampire.
Mark of the Vampire, yeah. And if it's anything like that, I don't.
Well, I don't think Mark of the Vampire is a bad picture, but no. So
I hate that, and yeah. I just hate the cheat ending. But when my Lost Films book came out, God, and what was that, 97, 98? I was doing a lot of radio interviews, and I would always start before we went on the air, and I would put a $5 bill on the table between me and the interviewer. and say, if nobody calls in about London After Midnight, this five is yours.
And you never gave it up.
I never have to give it up, no.
Yeah. So
people are so fascinated by that film. It's like that's the number one lost film of all.
The stills look great. What people don't realize is that, and if you read the cut in continuity or see, you know, Rick Schmidlin's reconstruction, that's a very small part of the film. It's mostly Polly Moran comic relief. And both David Bradley and William K. Everson saw it before the print went up in the MGM vault fire in the 60s. Yeah. They both saw it in the early 60s, and they both independently say the same thing. They said, Everson said, terrible movie. And Bradley described it in language that I can't use on a podcast, in his very colorful way. But they both said, yeah, it's just terrible. You know, lumbering film, you know, the couple minutes of cool vampire footage, and that's it. But it's amazing how it's captivated people. Now, if there were Lost Cheneys out there, I mean, I would much rather see, say, The Tower of Lies, which is a Victor Sjostrom picture, with Norma Shearer. So, you know, another He Who Gets Slapped, you know, could be a really good picture. Or The Big City, which is another one of the crime dramas from Todd Browning.
For me, it's Miracle Man.
Miracle Man. We've seen the short clips, and maybe we've seen the best part. I'm not sure. But Miracle Man, the early Universals, the one that, you know, people say, well, what would you pick? And it's a film most people haven't heard of. It's called The Chimney Secret. But the reason I picked that is, first, Chaney directed it, and he played a dual role. He played a young man and then an old bearded man. So it's one of his early makeup pictures. What's interesting about that one is that when he was sending pictures back to his brother George, you know, once or twice a year he would send a picture, oh, here's something I'm doing. But Chimney Secret, he sent multiple pictures of that. And I have to believe he was particularly proud of that because, again, he directed it and had a dual role in it. And so, you know, I'd love to see something like that. I think he directed six films. I'd love to see any of the six. They're all lost. Kaiser the Beast of Berlin, you know, would, although Chaney was not a major role, you know, that has got to be an interesting picture, as an extreme propaganda piece done during World War I. Father and the Boys was an early breakout picture. That would be great. Blind Bargain, actually, the other one, the horror buffs. Say, and again, there are prominent collectors who insist it exists, and no, it doesn't. There's really no evidence. I mean,
it's there with the uncut Magnificent Ambersons and all of Greed and
the 40 Reel Greed.
Yeah. Probably all in the same vault.
With
a frozen Walt Disney.
Well, everyone believes that, you know, there's a private collector out there who has this stuff. But the reality is, I mean, knowing collectors the way collectors are, much of their enjoyment comes from saying, I have it and you don't. And I just don't believe there are collectors out there sitting on this stuff, never letting it be seen, never letting anyone know. And when things slip out, I mean, there was the famous case of the guy who stole the only color print of Dr. X off the loading dock at MoMA, and, you know, the police eventually caught him and a number of things that he had stolen. But, you know, it was known there was a print out there stolen. They just didn't know who had it. And eventually he was tracked down, and then, of course, the UCLA did the restoration that we've seen today. But anyway, you know, I just don't believe there's that much out there. Having said that, stuff keeps turning up. I just heard this weekend, and I hope I'm not spreading a false rumor. I think this is true. Universal has turned up the original negatives on most of the missing color footage from Phantom of the Opera. And so, you know, originally some of the ballet sequences, a number of sequences. Now, what we have now, the Blu-ray that just came out has some additional color footage and another shameless plug. I did the commentary track on that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of color there, but there was much more. Most of the opera footage certainly from the 1930 reissue was done in color, and apparently they found much of that, which I find odd. You know, Universal owned it, and they had it in their vault, and they couldn't find it. Well, okay. I guess, I have stuff lost in my house, so I suppose it's not that unusual.
That stuff, sometimes it's just misfiled, sometimes it's... Now, I've heard a story, you're the perfect person to ask this. I heard the story many times that Chaney's film, The Unknown, was in plain view on a foreign archive shelf for years when it was thought to be lost, and everybody kept looking at it on the shelf thinking, someday we need to find out where this unknown picture is. Yeah. And is that really true?
That is true. It was the Cinémathèque Française, and all of their unknown material, unidentified, they mark as inconnu, unknown. And the unknown's release title in France was L'Inconnu, the unknown. And so it was just sitting there, and they said it was unknown, and somebody finally said, hey, let's take a hack at some of this, you know, this unknown material, see if we can identify it, and sure enough, it was the unknown, and that's where those prints come from.
I'm glad to know that's a true story.
Yeah.
I always loved it so much.
Well, you know, I mean, another one, you know, Warner, you know, The Animal Kingdom, the Leslie Howard picture, you know, it was a lost film for a number of years, and it was found sitting exactly where it was supposed to be in the Warner Brothers vault. And, you know, okay, it's a huge vault, thousands of titles, and all I can think of is, you know, Warner's did The Animal World, the Willis O'Brien, it's an Irwin Allen, and I think someone probably just had a temporary ischemic attack and said, oh, yeah, The Animal Kingdom. Oh, they mean The Animal World.
Or, while historians and film buffs and fans are obsessing about whether something exists or not within the corporate world of the studio, maybe they're not thinking about it so much. They're taking care of their business, and so things turn up when they turn up.
Well, and this stuff is showing up as, you know, studios more and more are getting interested in resurrecting some of this older material because they're seeing there is a market. You know, with 10 gazillion cable stations and the internet and the ability now to, digital's become very cheap, and the ability to do these custom knockoff DVDs the way, you know, Warner Brothers Archive is doing now. You know, they don't do 100,000 or a million, you know, Blu-ray run, you know, like they do for, you know, the latest, Adam Sandler picture. Mm-hmm. They have it digitally and they just press you a disc and you figure they're doing it for a buck and a quarter and selling it for 15 to 20 and you know they can make a modest profit doing that in these hard economic times. They'll take a modest profit.
Yeah, it's more than they would have made if they didn't sell it. So,
so Warner's is doing it. Fox is starting to do it, and more you're seeing that. And I know I just here at the convention I was talking briefly with Mike Feinberg at Universal and he said, you know, he's being tasked now with dredging up more of the Universal material. And, of course, Universal was worse than just about anyone
sure.
keeping Universal. And I just laughed and said, well, that's kind of a tough job. And
But they also control the Paramount stuff, too.
Right.
And that early Paramount is what's been woefully missing for years in terms of availability on video.
Oh, sure.
Because there's a lot of really good stuff there that we just haven't had access to except at festivals like CineCon and so forth.
Right. So I am encouraged that, you know, people will, you know, it's not like Universal in 48 where they said there's no market for these old films, let's melt them down for the silver. You know, now people are off, you know, trying to hunt these things down. In fact, I recently picked up a Show at Home print of the Coens and the Kellys, and it turns out Universal's doing a restoration on that. And I may have the only 16mm print. So, you know, we'll provide that as needed to fill in any gaps in the 35mm to do blow-ups and... to try and get some of these things seen.
Do you have other specific interests, or do you just have a general interest in cinema history? Are there other, like I have three or four different things that I tend to concentrate on in addition to just being interested in general, but I have three or four kind of manic interests. Are you similar like that?
I have too many manic interests. I mean, in terms of collecting, I mean, I would say the big things are Lon Chaney and Ronald Coleman. And don't ask me what those two have in common, other than they both begin with the letter C. Mm-hmm. But I have a lot of Coleman. I mean, even like, you know, I have Coleman TV shows. I actually got turned on to Coleman when I was in graduate school with an old girlfriend of mine who, you know, she said, oh, I love Ronald Coleman. I said, who's Ronald Coleman? And it's funny, when I went to graduate school, and I went to a school that had a terrific film program, we had one of the largest film budgets, it's North Carolina State, one of the largest budgets in the country for film. We ran 200 films a school year. And, you know, we ran classic films on Monday and Wednesday, foreign films on Tuesday, you know, we ran, you know, current films on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So we had a very active program. But I had led this sheltered life where I kind of knew silence, and I knew, which I'd only just started getting into late in college, and horror movies. So, you know, I you asked me about Gog and, the Day the Earth Stood Still, King Kong type things, and oh, I knew it all. But I never forget it, to show you how naive I was, and I just started dating this woman. And she said, well, there's a midnight double feature of Casablanca and Play It Again, Sam. I said, oh, I've never seen Casablanca. And, you know, here I am. I had gone to graduate school, made it through college, and I'd never seen Citizen Kane, Casablanca, Gone with the Wind, Singing in the Rain. You know, I'd never seen any of those films. And, you know, we're sitting, you know, watching Casablanca. I said, oh, this is pretty good. And I lean over and I said, who's the girl? I'd never seen an Ingrid Bergman movie. You know, so I mean, that's you know, I'd say she deserves a lot of credit for kind of turning me on to 30s films. You know, she was the one that introduced me to Bette Davis, who I really like. And but I just became a huge Coleman fan. So I like Coleman a lot, but I like on you know the main you know Chaplin, Keaton, Lloyd, Langdon, Laurel and Hardy. I've got extensive collections in those. Love Douglas Fairbanks, not just his swashbucklers, but even his early comedies. I like a lot. I'm a big fan of King Vidor and Frank Borzage. I like a lot, but I like German Expressionist a lot. You know, big fan of you know Murnau, Fritz Lang, Paolini. You know, I mean, just a little of everything. I have pretty broad tastes. But certainly, you know, action adventure pictures, horror mystery, I like a lot.
Were you always on track to go into science, and to always keep your arts things as interests and hobbies? I mean, was it always your aim to go into what you eventually did as a living?
It's sort of, but not exactly. I mean, I was, I was always good in science and math, and you know, they kept, you know, when I was in school, they kept pushing me ahead. So I was one of these kids that in all these experimental classes, let's get a math, start an algebra a year early. But I had, frankly, not very good science teachers in high school, and it kind of turned me off. So actually, when I entered college, I was a double major in photography and math. And I was actually putting myself through college doing freelance photography at the time. In fact, I was playing in a rock band and doing freelance photography, and I was an instructor at Cleveland Institute of Electronics part-time. And that's how I put myself through college. But when I went, my idea was I was going to do sort of clinical and medical photography, which I knew a guy who did this, and I said, oh, that sounds kind of cool to go into the operations, take pictures. I didn't find out later that there's like almost no market for this. And so when I showed up at college, I went to Kent State undergraduate. One of the advisors said, well, if you're going to do that, you got to take, you know, freshman biology. Oh, I hated biology in high school. Horrible, horrible, boring, just cutting up salamanders and things. I hated it. He said, well, you know, if you're going to do it, it's going to be a science requirement. I said, all right, I'll take it. And I took it, had a great instructor, and just fell in love with it. And, you know, by my second quarter, I had switched to like a double major in biology, chemistry. Eventually, I got a degree in molecular biology, went on, got graduate degrees in toxicology and genetics.
Wow.
So.
Well, speaking as someone who went into film history full-time, you made the right choice.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the thing is, I can be gainfully employed doing science and make a, you know, make an impact. I mean, I can honestly say with a straight face, lives are saved because of what I do.
Yeah.
And in fact, right now I run a large program for the National Institutes of Health. Basically, any drug for infectious disease that comes through the federal government comes through me on the way for clinical trials. So all the things for anthrax, plague, tularemia, smallpox, hepatitis, influenzas. You know, I mean, when swine flu broke, you know, President Obama was, you know, swore in. Kathleen Sebelius is head of DHHS, and she's on the phone with the director of NIAID, you know, by 5:30 in the afternoon, and by, you know, 8 a.m. the next morning, they're saying, what can you do with swine flu? And we said, well, you know, we can screen all the marketed drugs against it to try and quickly find a drug. So I'm sort of in the thick of it on the infectious disease side, and I donate a lot of time to malaria projects. You can't make any money on treating malaria because the only people with it are insanely poor. Sure. But I, you know, we come up with malaria drugs. We don't even bother filing patents because it's not worth the money. We just make it publicly available and then let organizations pick it up. So I'm hoping I have a very modest goal before I retire. I want to cure either malaria or TB. I'll take one or the other. And that's my modest science goal. The other thing I'm kind of known for in the film world is keeping a database of archival holdings of early films. And people say, well, you know, how did you get doing that? And it was, again, because I'm anal, and B, because I'm a pretty good researcher. And this started about the time I moved to California, when I just started, you know, things like American Movie Classics, back when it used to be a good station, you know, would running all these early RKO and 20th Century Fox pictures. And I found that I started watching the same film over again, and I'd say, well, wait a minute, I've seen this. And I'm halfway through, and I say, you know, I've seen this, I think. And I was seeing so many films, I couldn't keep track. So I started making lists. And, you know, being the anal researcher that I am, the list soon became, you know, every American-produced feature film made before 1950, which is about, you know, 11,000 silence, 5,500 30s films, and about 4,500 40s films. But then the question became, well, you know, gee, why are there, you know, some of these RKO films? You know, there's, you know, 1,000 RKOs, and I've seen, you know, 960 of them. What's with these 40? Well, and then it was things like The Monkey's Paw, which is lost. So then I said, well, gee, you know, what I really want to do is know what's available out there. So I started working with archives, and I went through, I got access, you know, again, through connections, friends, doing favors, whatnot, to the complete Library of Congress archival lists, to the George Eastman House list. I went through the MoMA list, the UCLA, British Film Institute. And then people started feeding me things, and I would enter, and over the years, it's built up quite a database. What's funny is that, James Cozart at LOC is frequently contacting me saying, you know, what do you show Library of Congress having on this? I said, wait a minute, James, you work for Library of Congress. He said, well, I want to compare your records to ours because yours are usually right. Because I got it from the primary material where they're doing it from the card catalog that came off a handwritten list that came off the primary material. And so, you know, I often compare notes on what's available. So I've done this, over the years and have amassed a pretty large database. So I often get the question for shows like Cinecon where they will say, hey, what does Museum of Modern Art have that's interesting? And I'll pull down a list and send it in and say, well, you know, here's some that look really interesting that I've never seen, so they've probably never been shown. So anyway, that's how that list came to be. So I'm a go-to source sometimes on archival lists.
Well, do you find that the statistics that everybody tosses around are off the mark in terms of how many lost silent films there are, et cetera? Because when I wrote my lost films book, I believe that all the archivists were telling me that it was about 80% lost.
That's about right. Well, I thought you were going to say, the figure often people say is 90% lost, and that's not right. I mean, the official figure for, let's just talk right now about American-produced silent features, and there's a little under 11,000. You can argue about what's a feature. I use four reels as a feature, and some people would say five, but a little under 11,000, 23% survive. And survive complete, essentially complete is probably about 20 to 21%. So the 80% is not far off. Shorts, there is no good database. I think short survival is probably a little better because shorts tended to be reissued more. Even you look at major comedians, I mean, you know, Chaplin has one lost film, you know, Keaton has one or two, Laurel and Hardy have one lost film. You know, that's not by accident. I mean, the shorts are around. Now, if you went to obscure comedians, then it's, you know, maybe there was less of an interest of reissuing or distributing. But yeah, it's about, I use the 23% figure. 23%, you know, are known to survive. There's probably a few other things out there, you know, just as an example, these New Zealand films that just turned up. So let's say 25% survive. 75% lost. It's not good statistics at all.
When the New Zealand turned up this Billy and His Pal, that was only the fifth of the Star Film Ranch films that survived, and they made at least 76 films, as far as we know, in that year they were there. So for kind of orphan studios and that sort of thing, the survival rate is much dimmer because they had no further life. I mean, once they were done.
Yeah. Well, films that got sold for state rights, the independents sometimes do better than the major studios because they would get sold on a state's rights basis. And so the prints were actually physically sold, whereas MGM, they wanted their prints back. Now, MGM would be very good, and MGM still is one of the highest survivals of any studio. They would be good if not for the 66 vault fire, you know, that took out One and After Midnight, you know, The Big City, The Divine Woman, significant number of films. But, you know, Fox and Universal were quite neglectful. Paramount was pretty neglectful. Columbia, we probably don't care so much. But the major studios, they really didn't care for some of these. MGM is the one that, you know, is better survival than most. And even then, I don't remember the exact number, but I want to say 70-some percent of the MGM survive.
Of the major studios, is Fox the worst, do you think?
Oh, Universal's the worst.
Universal
by far is the worst, and then Fox, I would say, is second. Paramount and Columbia, third. I mean, there's MGM of the major studios is pretty good. They saved everything. They tried to save everything, and then they lost some things. Most of the other studios, I mean, Universal is the one that intentionally destroyed all their silence. I mean, Universal, if not for show-at-home prints, this home movie 16mm prints, there probably wouldn't be more than about 15 or 20 Universal features from the silent era. Because they destroyed everything that didn't have a soundtrack. So that's why they have nice prints of the reissue of Phantom of the Opera and, The Man Who Laughs and, you know, pictures like that. But they, you know, I mean, there's no good 35 material on Hunchback of Notre Dame. I mean, I've heard tell that there's some 35 material kicking around, but, you know, what we've all seen is from the show at home print. So imagine, if not for the show at home prints, you know, we wouldn't even have Hunchback. So, it's sad, but, you know, having said that, there's still a lot of material for us to see and a lot to preserve.
And, you know, as I learn every year at CineCon, there's still a lot of things I've never even heard of that, you know, these silents that I've seen this weekend, I've seen a couple of them, but most of them are completely new to me. So there's still, I mean, there might be a lot of lost films, but how can I complain when there are still probably hundreds of films that I've never even seen?
You'll be hard-pressed to see all the extant silence, and that's just American silence.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of, you know, French, German, Danish, Swedish. I mean, the San Francisco Silent Film Festival has periodically been running Chinese silence. I mean, you know, who'd have thunk it?
Sure.
So there is a lot out there.
Yeah, that's the good thing to know. We'll never actually get through what we have. So that's an optimistic way of being pessimistic, I guess.
Yep.
Well, thanks very much, John. I sure appreciate it.
Okay.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with John Marsalis. What an interesting guy and a good guy. And I listened to him play later that very day and enjoyed it just as I always do. I look forward to CineCon every year, even though it means I'm 1 year closer to the grave. But I do look forward to CineCon just because of the interesting and sometimes obscure movies. I'd say often obscure movies that I see there, but also the great music that I hear there. Not only John, of course, but Phil Carley and Frederick Hodges and all the other accompanists who come through CineCon and make each silent film an experience in itself. So I hope you enjoyed that, and I hope that we'll have John back one of these days, because clearly we got lots and lots more to talk to him about. And maybe I'll brush up on my toxicology by the next time, and we can take this take this podcast into areas where it was never meant to dwell. Before I go, I've got something that's been on my chest. There seems to be a raft, a plethora, perhaps, of articles and things that I'm seeing on Facebook and Twitter and just in the general social sphere, whining about how kids today, those pesky kids, hate movies of the past and won't watch black and white and they won't watch anything. And I just read an article the other day that recounted the experiences of a film professor who showed Singing in the Rain to his class, and the class was not impressed, and they tittered their way through it. They couldn't understand why people would just sing out of nowhere. They thought it was dull. They thought the people were hammy. They just didn't like anything about it. Now, clearly, these kids were idiots on one level. I mean, I'm not going to sugarcoat that. But I'm not quite sure that I agree that this means that the world is going to hell in a handbasket in terms of appreciation of classic films. Films of every era have a different style. A film from 1901 is very different from a film from 1921, which is incredibly different from a film from 1951, and so on and so on and so on. You can't just spring those earlier styles on somebody out of the blue and expect them to understand it and work with it. Frankly, when I read that article about the professor who lambasted his kids for not liking Singing in the Rain, although I think I probably would have at least been tempted to lambast them as well, but I also thought, well, gee, they probably should have been taught better before they saw it. They probably should have been prepared for what they were going to see, to start to understand that style of filmmaking and that kind of acting, and to understand what was truly remarkable and innovative about it, but also to help them grasp just the techniques of the time and the mores and all of this that was on view there, so that they could come to understand how utterly delightful that film is, and it is one of the greatest films ever made. And it hurts me a little bit that these kids didn't automatically see that, because the first time I ever saw it immediately. I was just blown away the first time I saw the film. But that was in the 70s, not in the aught 12. So that's different, I guess. But also, come to think of it, I saw it in 35 millimeter in a theater the first time. The same week, I think I saw Chinatown for the first time, which was a brand new film at that moment. And those two styles could not be more wildly divergent. And yet, I love them both and still find it in my heart and in my imagination to love all sorts of things of all sorts of styles. People just need to be taught. And people of my so-called generation were no more open to silent films than kids today are. As a general rule, there were only a few of us who really jumped on that bandwagon and really loved what we were seeing and embraced it. And I think a lot of the kids today don't even bother to check it out, but a few do, and among the few who do, there are some who are going to immediately find it compelling and charming and wonderful and pursue it. These things don't die out as much as we seem to be afraid that they're going to. In fact, movie preservation is at a better state today than it's ever been in the history of show business. And we are presented with films and we have access to things that that are far in excess from, say, when I first started trying to watch classic films. I had to really seek them out, and it was hard. And had to go to theaters, or had to go to archives, or had to go to libraries and check out 16mm prints or 8mm prints. And then, you know, the age of VHS came along, and all we saw were these horrible-looking pan-and-scan, grainy-looking things, and it was not much better. And so I didn't watch movies that way either, as a general rule. Always preferring the theatrical experience and what real film looks like. But the home experience is getting better and better all the time. And more important, it's getting more and more filled up with what exists. And we have things available to us easily today that I would have driven hours to see a bad print of when I was 25 years old. And so these are actually happy times in some ways. And so I guess my point is, let's not paint all these kids with a broad brush, because I think that some of them are going to get it. And those that do are going to become the real buffs and fans, and I dare say experts and scholars of tomorrow. And some of them aren't going to get it. You know, there are kids I went to high school with who to this day would snort in derision if you suggested watching even a Buster Keaton film or a Charlie Chaplin film or something that's undeniably great. They would still just find it completely out of their wheelhouse and wouldn't do it. So it's not necessarily a generational thing. It's a thing of perception. And people either have the imagination to see what's going on or they don't. I hear a lot of people talk about how they don't like musical films because they just can't believe that somebody would burst into song out of nowhere and that the orchestra would be playing in the background. Well, these people are just ignorant, and that seems harsh to say. I just mean they're ignorant of a certain way of looking at something and with using their imagination in a certain way. And I don't want to come down on those people. People like what they like, and it's none of my business what they do. But I am in favor of having as much fun and as much pleasure and as much joy out of movies as you can possibly get. And I find that if I watch a Georges Méliès film from 1903, it's filled with imagination. It's filled with color and beauty and wit. And then 100 years later, we see things where the filmmakers have special effects and other filmmaking tools that Georges Méliès couldn't have even dreamed of when he was making his films. And yet, are they 100 years better than what he was making? Well, only in some ways, because imagination is really the key, and creativity, and people who have something to say, and people who have a distinct way of saying it. And that transcends any age. It transcends all the eras. So I guess all I'm urging is that we should have a little tolerance. Those of us who love these films should have tolerance for people who don't love them, and try to, if we're really that interested in converting them and being evangelical about it, then find ways to open the door a little bit. I always find that comedy is the best way, as a general rule. I've never shown anybody Buster Keaton's Sherlock Jr. who didn't just love it, no matter who they are or what they like. Under the right circumstances, they're just captivated by it, and who wouldn't be? And so I think we should be tolerant of these people who don't like what we like, because if we present it properly and if we work it right, then we can get them to start liking these things, and then we'll all have something in common, and more important, they'll have more fun to have. Because as we were talking, I think, in this interview with John Marsalis, we were talking about how many lost films there are, but the fact remains is that we could all spend the rest of our lives constantly watching the films that exist and never get through nearly all of them. Never. So it is sad that so many are lost, but there's really much more than we can even watch. So there's lots and lots of stuff to discover for every one of us. And that's all I have to say, that people should be open to having new adventures and finding that an obscure silent film from 1922 can be just as eye-opening and just as fun and just as inspiring as any huge budget box office blah that comes out from, you know, from the big studios today. And the only thing that matters, no matter what, is whether it's a good film. And the style is secondary, the technique is secondary, because those things are always going to be changing. Acting styles change, cinematic styles change, directorial styles change. That doesn't mean that everything necessarily gets better and better and better. Is a star of today better than Jimmy Cagney? No, but Jimmy Cagney was very much of his time, but he was also very much of himself. And he was great. And he would be too mannered for films today, but that doesn't mean that he wasn't great. And I think the real hope is that people can broaden their horizons a little bit, can open up their eyes and ears and discover that there is a lot more to learn from all these different kinds of films, and how much pleasure there is yet to have. That's the thing I keep saying. Pleasure, fun. it's not a, you know, it's not a chore to watch a great film. It's not something that's dull and something that has to be endured. It's exciting. It's fun. It's terrific. And movies like Citizen Kane or Sunrise or any of these films that are acknowledged classics, they aren't acknowledged classics because they're dull, because they're boring. They're acknowledged classics because they work. And they have compelling characters, and they have interesting plots, and they have beautiful techniques in photography, and in the case of the sound films, great dialogue, and great musical scores, and all this. And so it's just something that I hope that people will continue to be more broad-minded about. And if they aren't, then let us not worry so much about it. And if somebody else doesn't like Citizen Kane, it doesn't detract from my enjoyment one iota. So let them think what they want to. Let them watch Two and a Half Men and be happy. That's that'll be fine with me. So I will now get off my high horse and start planning the next episode of the Commentary Track. And I am deeply grateful for your tuning in to this. And I hope you'll go to the website, and I hope you'll order books and videos, and go through Amazon to order them if you can, because I'll get a little bit of a kickback, and that will certainly help me stay going. And right now it looks like it's touch and go, but by George, I'm going to keep plugging away. So thanks a lot. Thanks to Claire McCullough Thompson, my wife, who's the announcer. Thanks to James Hutchin, who designed my website. Thanks to Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for my wonderful theme music. And thanks again to John C. Marsalis for being my guest today. So we'll see you next week. And don't you worry. We're going to fix it in post.